You are listening to Punk News Podcast 217. That's 217. Welcome back to the Punk News Podcast. This is features editor John Gentile, kicking, sticking, flipping, and ripping all the hottest, the jammest, the funkiest, the brand newest punk rock news and music reviews and brand new sounds just for you, our lovely Punk News listeners, broadcasting to 182 countries, over 200 million listeners, Punk News Podcast. Thank you all for listening. We are here with one of my main men, one of my eternal champions, if you're talking about Michael Moorcock. We are here with I'm features editor John Gentile, but we are here with managing editor Adam White, who just got back from a vacay with his baby. Adam White, how did your vacay with your baby go?
Did you say brown new sounds in your intro ramble?
The reason I said that was because I was listening to Ween earlier today. Actually, I was listening to a Ween spinoff earlier today, and Aaron Freeman says, "You know, I'm still down with the Brown," which is like a Ween reference. And so it was a Freudian slip as to my Ween fanaticism.
Okay, it wasn't like a South Park thing.
Well, I actually think it's like the same thing, like the Brown note. I think it's the same thing.
Ah, okay. See, there we go. Anyways, yeah. We had a good time. We went to a place that I have to imagine would be very near to your heart, John, for some reason.
Oh, you went to the record store?
Well, I went to a record store, yes. But outside of going to a record store, we took a quick little trip to the hometown of Dio.
Oh, all right. Dio. Yes.
Which is not the reason why we went there.
Are you sure? Are you sure?
I thought maybe there'll be a statue. Like you know how if you go to Austin they have a statue of
Danzig.
Yeah, no, they were going to make that statue of Danzig riding the dragon. No, but isn't there a statue of like Stevie Ray Vaughan or something like that?
Melbourne's got Bon Scott of AC/DC.
Yeah, so I don't know. Anyway, so music cities sometimes have statues of music people, and I thought to myself, maybe there'll be a big, you know, Ronnie James Dio statue in the middle of Cortland, New York. But no, there isn't. We went to one of those little lodge places that have like, it's like a lodgy looking hotel that has like an indoor water park, because I have a slightly under 2 year old, and running around in a water park is that's one of the things that a slightly under 2 year old can do. So that was what we did. So I was, yeah, on the way back, we popped into Syracuse and I went to a record store, but that's not interesting to anyone but me. But
how great they like they're like, come see the life size Ronnie James Dio statue, and it's like 4'11". It's like
it's like fire shoots out of, I don't know, there was no Dio statue, none that I saw at least. So, and Portland, you got to get on that.
And speaking of a guy that used to live down the street from Dio, and this is true, mind you, we've got reviews writer Ricky Frankel. Ricky Frankel, A, how close did you used to live to Ronnie James Dio? I believe pretty close, right?
Only like a mile or two away. I got his autograph a few years before he died.
I mean, that is what did he autograph? Like a picture or a record or what?
I kind of decorated my room with like printed out album art, just like, you know, that you can get like done at a print shop.
Wait,
so
you had him sign like an 8x11 like piece of paper that you printed from your color printer? Is that what you had him sign?
No, it was glossy. It's you'd have to see it. I'll tweet it later. But yeah, he was cool enough to, I gave it to my friend who was his neighbor, because he wasn't there when we went to see him, and they came back like a week later and they had it signed for me, which was awesome.
That's cool, man. That's cool. Do you guys think the listeners all know who Ronnie James Dio is? Like, I feel I'm sort of losing perspective, honestly. Like, maybe they don't know who Dio is.
Explain.
Well, listen, kids, if you don't know who Ronnie James Dio is, that's no problem. You know, not everybody knows everything about everything, but you should definitely check out Ronnie James Dio. Ronnie James Dio is actually quite a varied musician. He started out doing doo-wop as Ronnie D. Dio and the, I forget, Ronnie Dio and the something. He was doing doo-wop. Then he moved basically on to early rock and roll. Then he moved on to hard rock with the band Elf. Then he moved on to Rainbow, which was actually an extension of Elf. Then he moved on to Black Sabbath after Ozzy Osbourne quit. Then he formed his own heavy metal band, Dio. And that's Ronnie James Dio, heavy metal legend. Check him out. Let's get this podcast started. You know, just yesterday I went to a concert. I saw Ohm, which features Alice's Narrative of Sleep. And it was awesome. It was so awesome. But while I was there, I was thinking, you know, most concerts I go to are, like, really, really good. But sometimes, like, very, very, very rarely I'll go to a concert and it's, like, really bad. So I guess my question for you guys is, like, what's the worst concert that you guys have ever been to? I guess maybe I'll start and give you guys time to think. What happens when I was living in the Bay Area, my pal Brian came out to visit, who worked at my old job with me. And we really had nothing to do one night. And so in San Francisco, they often have, like, surprise shows by musicians that they announce, like, that afternoon and you can go to that night. And I'm a pretty big hip hop guy, but I really like old school hip hop. But they did a surprise show for Mos Def, which was pretty unique because Mos Def doesn't do a whole lot of shows, and he's very, very hip. So we went and saw Mos Def. Let me tell you, it was the wackest show I've ever seen. It was bad. Like, Mos Def was not good live. Like, he comes out. And, like, I love a loose hip-hop show where, like, they're deciding what they want to do on stage, freestyling, or say, play this track, and they play this track. KRS-One is the master of that. But Mos Def comes out, like he stands around, looks at the audience, he says, all right, let's play this song. He does, like, half the song, and then, like, just, like, lets it run out. And then, like, they do another half the song, and lets it run out. And this goes on for, like, an hour and a half, and it's really boring. And then at the end of an hour and a half, he just starts playing songs that he likes. Like, he like, goes behind the DJ's deck, and he's like, oh, yeah, I really like this song. And he would just put it on and just, like, stand there and be like, yeah, this song's really great. This song's really great. And we stayed there for the whole – it was, like, a three-hour show just to see, like, if it would get good. And it didn't. It was just, like – Chuck D's talked about this of Public Enemy. He's talked about how hip-hop kind of has a reputation for not doing great shows, and that's why a lot of the early hip-hoppers, you know, Boogie Down Productions, KRS-One, Public Enemy, have, you know, do really amazing, some of the best live shows ever. But I gotta say, Mos Def was not good live. It was just boring, not energetic, and it's like he didn't even want to be there, but he clearly did because it was like a surprise announced show. So I'm still confused about it. It was not a good show.
You know, I got two that come to mind, and they're both from my youth, and they both kind of, I guess, they probably were not bad shows, but they were bad shows for me, and I can't look at them more objectively than that. Like, I'm looking at them just, like, through my experience, where, like, I got home and I was like, that was not very fun. And the one was when I first started going to universities. This would have been, I think, 2001 or so. I'm in Guelph, Ontario, and we had a local promoter there called Sellout Productions that put on all the shows at the local punk rock club, which is a place called the Trashteria at the time. And one of the first shows that happened there that I was there for, so it would have been in, like, September of 2001 when I would have started university. So it was, like, one of the first local Guelph shows that I got out to once I got there was a band from Canada that a lot of people liked and like now that they're playing the reunion circuit called Grade. And there was a lot of love for Grade at the time, even from Punk News, actually. Punk News owner, operator, Aubin, I remember, I think, was a big fan of a record called Separate the Magnets that they put out back in 1997. But Grade, they were at the time on Victory. They were doing things that really started to personify this movement within punk rock that it turns out I was not at all a fan of, which was that kind of like that post-hardcore slash emo sing scream vocals thing, right? Mm-hmm. And that was, I realized that I was maybe a little bit too old to be into that because it was kind of the younger generation than me that was really into it. But I remember, you know, everyone loves Grade. They had just released the record Head First Straight to Hell. I went out to that show and there was full of people that liked it. And I'm there and I'm like, yes, I'm at a local punk rock show at a trashy local punk rock bar in this bar that I'm going to be seeing all sorts of shows during the 4 years that I'm living in this town. And man, was I not a fan of that shit. And I feel bad because, like, a lot of people still to this day, like, love that band. Like, they're playing reunion shows all around here and people, like, run out to see them. And they have an incredible amount of goodwill. But just, oh, if it was ever, like, it was ever really clear to me that, like, there was just, like, a certain subgenre of punk that I was just not going to click with, like, it was evident there. And I was just like, ugh, like, I do not like this music at all. I mean, I don't even really remember if, like, was the band good or not that night. They were probably good, but blah, like,
you couldn't even, like, tell.
I couldn't tell. It's just, that's not my thing, and it really drove that home. The other one, and this one totally was like, this next one was really more evidence of, I think it's one of these shows that kind of helped me get into the mode of which I go to shows now. So I will kind of, like, go to most shows solo these days, and I think this is part of being older. Only because, well, you know, my wife will be at home with our kids, so I'm getting out to go see a show. Someone's got to watch the kid. There's that part of it. But also just all the friends that I used to have that were around when we were in either university or high school that we always used to go to shows with, well, they don't live here anymore. But this was one of the last shows that I did drag a bunch of people out to. And it became really evident to me that, like, I shouldn't be doing that anymore. And I remember we went up to Toronto to see the New Bomb Turks play the legendary Horseshoe Tavern, which is one of the oldest and most storied rock and roll bars in Toronto. And this was probably right after Turks had released The Night Before the Day the Earth Stood Still, which is the last record they released. And it came out on Gearhead back in, I don't know, 2000 and let's say 3. And I remember we went up there and it was pouring rain. And whenever we go to Toronto, it's always pouring rain. But we went up there and it was pouring rain. And I dragged one of my best friends around with me. And I dragged my girlfriend, my future wife, with me. And we go into the show and the sound was mixed, like, super punishingly loud. And someone, I forget who, one of the three of us was sick or had a headache or something like that. And it was just like, it was one of these, like, man, I dragged two people out through the shit to see a band that they've never heard, that I'm the only one that's really into, and I don't really feel like I can have a good time because I dragged people out here that are just, like, being punished by, like, the incredibly weirdly mixed sound right now. And it was just bad scene all around. And it was kind of like, you know what, if there's some weird band that I'm into, but, like, the rest of the people in my life aren't, I should probably just go to the show and not try to, like, make it a, you know, cultural event where I'm pulling all these people into it. I don't know. That one struck me as bad. And it's a band I love.
Actually, I agree with you. I don't mind going to shows alone, especially recently, because I've had, you know, I have friends that were really into, like, the grungy, like, you know, more hardcore stuff. And there are bands like Lawrence Arms where I wanted to see them, but no one wanted to go see them either. So I'm like, you know what? Fuck you guys. I'm going anyway. But the worst shows, I mean, only I have a few that come to mind. There was when I was a freshman in college, a friend of mine was a bass player for a death metal band. And I went to school in Northern California. They had a show in Sacramento, which was about 3 hours away. And I used to, like, help them out with, like, their merch booth or whatever, because I really wasn't into death metal. But we get there. We make the drive. We're on time. Everything's going well. And it's at some really just weird, sketchy-looking bar, and they won't let us in because we're all under 21. So they only let the band in, and, like, only 6 people showed up that were allowed to go inside. So that really sucked. And then in 2011, Rage Against the Machine did their only show in the country in Los Angeles. It was LA Rising Festival, and it was like this band from ska mariachi band called El Gran Silencio opened. Immortal Technique did a set, and then Lauryn Hill, Rise Against, Muse, then Rage ended the night. And this was also my favorite concert I've ever gone to, but my God, Lauryn Hill was awful. And really? Granted, she was horrible.
Was she bad or just not anything? I'm a big fan of Lauryn Hill's recorded stuff. I think she's a great artist, but I mean...
Granted, she had had a kid like a week or two before the concert, and I was also disappointed because the Roots were supposed to be in her place. She was never supposed to be there, but the Roots canceled, I guess. And yeah, it was just like, I didn't get her band at all. It was just like her singing, and then she has like a guitar and all the instruments, stuff like that, but she has a 4-string bassist and then like a 6-string bassist, like kind of taking the lead on everything. And it just sounded just fucking weird. And I just could not wait for I think Rise Against was up next. I couldn't wait for them to get on. And we just had to stand in the Los Angeles heat in the middle of August, just waiting for her to end. And I think that was about an hour set.
Did she do Killing Me Softly at least?
I'm pretty sure she did. Well, it was a while ago.
Well, there you have it, folks. Lauryn Hill was killing Ricky Softly with her song. Let's talk about a show that won't suck, or hopefully won't suck. I don't think it'll suck. The Bouncing Souls have announced their annual Home for the Holiday shows. This is number 8. Every year in Asbury Park, right after Christmas time, the Bouncing Souls do between 3 and 5 shows or so, about that amount. And they usually stack the bills pretty heavily. This year, I guess the bills are pretty heavily stacked. The first day, December 26th, is Bouncing Souls, Bane, Blanks 77, quite surprisingly, and Morning Glory.
Woo!
December 27th is Bouncing Souls. This is probably the big hit that a lot of people are excited about. None More Black, as well as The Scandals and Van Pelt. And on the 28th is Bouncing Souls, Jesse Malin, Frankie Arrow, and Celebration, and Seaside Caves. So I guess the question is, are you guys excited for this? Would you guys go had you the opportunity? Are you excited about None More Black? And did Blank 77 catch you off guard? Because it sure did catch me off guard.
Blank 77 does kind of catch me off guard. I mean, it's cool. I mean, the Souls have a lot of... God, this sounds so... Well, we're going to talk about Rancid later, so I can say something like this. They show a lot of respect for the Roots. So I could, you know... It's nice to see every once in a while they pull in a band like that to play. Blank 77 feels like this has to be the first time we've mentioned that band in 10 years.
What is it like Blank 77, just the casualties, but like not even?
I don't know. They're not like a UK 82 band or anything.
They are a UK 82 band, but they're from the United States. They formed in 1990. I mean, they're a street punk group. You know, they play with like Total Chaos and those kind of guys, you know? And,
Oh, I thought they were older than that. Okay.
So, I give props to Bouncing Souls for doing a... honestly, I love varied lineups. And this is a varied lineup, especially the first thing. Bouncing Souls, which is, you know, I guess, just American punk, I guess. Bane, which is hardcore. Blank 77, which is American, but more like UK 82 stuff. And Morning Glory. That's a nice stacked lineup. So I appreciate the varied lineup.
I'm curious about that last day where they're playing with Jesse Malin. Whenever I see him pop up, I've always got to assume that it is a really strictly regional thing, like his appeal. Because I mean, like for those that don't know, Jesse Malin played in a kind of like a glam punk band back in the, let's say, 90s called D-Generation I don't think they ever had a hit, but they were one of those bands that was always kind of like on the cusp of having a hit or something like that. Like they were a buzzed about band for a little while. They actually got a shout out by Rancid, funny enough, during on Life Won't Wait, I think. And the song might have been Cooper's or something like that. At one point, they start like name checking a bunch of bands, and D-Generation is in that list. But he's been doing kind of like a solo singer songwriter thing for a long time. That's not bad or anything, but. I think that, like, you know, if you're in the maybe New York or New Jersey area or something like that, like Jesse Malin is a big draw. And it's kind of cool to see him show up on that.
I'd go to see Morning Glory.
You go to see Morning Glory. Of course.
Yes, I would. I mean, I still haven't. I need to see them live. I would totally go to the first show.
Yeah, I mean, if you're into Morning Glory, Morning Glory is a phenomenal show. I saw them twice. The first time actually was one of the worst shows I ever went to, but it wasn't Morning Glory's fault. It was at this place in Santa Cruz called the Bike Church, and at the first note, the entire system like blew out. So Ezra did the best he could. He basically did like an acoustic show on an electric guitar. But, like, you couldn't hear anything at all, you know? Second show I saw him was with that Direct Hit tour, and Morning Glory came out. I mean, it was a Unitarian Church in Philadelphia, a pretty small venue. But Morning Glory came out and did, like, a big rock, punk rock and roll show. I loved it. Morning Glory is great. If you get a chance to see him live. So I guess we should bring it down a little bit. Morrissey, he's had quite the eventful year, but he announced... I guess in an interview, he stated that actually he had cancer, and he even suggested that he might still have cancer. Here's what Morrissey said. They have scraped cancerous tissues 4 times already, but whatever. If I die, then I die. And if I don't, then I don't. Right now, I feel good. I am aware that in some of my recent photos, I look somewhat unhealthy, but that's what illness can do. I'm not going to worry about that. I'll rest when I'm dead. Morrissey released World Peace is None of Your Business earlier this year. I think it's one of his best albums. Online, Jason Heller, who does a lot of writing for the AV Club and Pitchfork, and honestly, I think he's one of the better music critics, music writers out there, he said he thought it was suspicious that this info came out the same exact day that Johnny Marr's solo album came out. I don't know if there's a big scheme behind this or not, but I guess I was mostly – you know, a lot of the readers said, like, you know, I hope he dies or I'm glad he gets cancer. You know, I mean, unless a guy – I mean, I don't think you should ever wish cancer on anybody. Cancer is bad, bad, bad news. And I think it's just kids kind of just, you know, being, you know, snotty. Like, they don't actually mean it. But I won't ever wish cancer on anybody. And even if someone, like, differs with you from a philosophical standpoint, I mean, you shouldn't wish death, particularly cancer, on them. But I think the kids were just, you know, just – being trolls or, you know, I don't think most of the kids that say, I hope he does die, like, I don't think they really meant that, or I hope they don't really mean that.
Kids are just dicks on the internet. I don't know if you'd read too much into that, but, yeah, I mean, like, that's horrible news for anyone. I don't know about him trying to upstage Johnny Marr with a cancer announcement made in a Spanish language newspaper. Like, that seems like a pretty... Well, A, that's horrible, but B, that's how could you orchestrate that? Like, Morrissey has a secret influence over the publishing schedule of a newspaper in Spain.
He did manage to get the New York Dolls back together. He knows how to plot a course, let me tell you that.
I guess, but I don't know about that one.
You know, I mean, I agree. I don't think it was probably to, like, to derail that album announcement, but... It is a little bit curious that he only how long ago did he cancel that tour?
Which one?
The last one.
That was like 3 months ago, I think.
I mean, the timeline kind of works out. Maybe he got spooked and thought maybe this isn't the best time to tour if I have cancer.
Yeah, I mean, I feel bad for him, and, you know, he took a lot of hits for canceling the tour. But on the other hand, in some cases, it is the little boy who cried wolf. You know, Morrissey
oh, yeah.
notorious for canceling shows. And if he did cancel the last few shows because he has cancer, which is incredibly sad, he's probably not going to get that much sympathy because he's canceled shows for, like, broken hangnails before, you know?
Well, let's talk about the elephant in the room, though. You know, Mr. Healthy Living, Mr. Healthy, you know, lifestyle anti-meat guy, you know, meat causes cancer and heart disease, might have cancer.
True. But, I mean, there is no one identifiable cause of cancer.
Absolutely.
And so I guess maybe your argument is that Morrissey's guide to not getting cancer might not be as accurate as he makes it out to be.
I just think he should stop imposing it on everyone.
Well, there you go. So anyway, no matter your position on Morrissey, I hope he gets better, and I hope anybody with cancer gets better. And that's all I can really say about that. You know, cancer sucks, man.
Yeah, absolutely.
The Melvins, in happier news, the Melvins have released a streaming for the new album. The new album is called Hold It In. It's half Melvins, half Butthole Surfers, actually. It's Buzz Osborne, Dale Crover, Paul Leary, and Jeff Pincus. And man, I gotta say, this album is classic Melvins. This is really, like, I know Melvins fans have been waiting for an album like this for a long while. Even though it's four-piece, Melvins are usually three-piece, but this is four-piece Melvins. But it's got the heavy, low rumbling sludge, but also their experimental stuff. The second track, I think it's called, like, I Will Wait or something, really blew my mind. I love it when the Melvins do, like, Melvins have so many weird different tracks, it's hard to get surprised by them, but this one is really surprising. On the second track, they almost do a Neil Young trance type thing, where it's kind of like Melvins doing Kraftwerk, like, real processed, almost synth 80s vocals. It sounds like a 80s synth song from the Melvins, which is wild. The rest of the album is, you know, hard, heavy, really low, really rumbling. I dug it. I'm super excited for this new album. I mean, if you ask me, the Melvins are a band that just keeps putting out great record after great record after great record. And I wonder, maybe you guys can comment on this. You know, a lot of bands, like, say, Bouncing Souls or whatever, they put out a new album every 3 or 4 years, you know. Back in the 70s, you know, Bowie, Judas Priest, even the Rolling Stones, Beatles back in the late 60s, they'd put out 2 albums a year, you know, plus singles. The Melvins have been putting out about 2 albums a year for the past 6 or 7 years. Do you think that maybe creativity is better sparked by rapid output rather than, you know, 3 or 4 year lapse between work?
I've expressed an opinion on this actually thing before. It might have been on the show. It might have been way early in the show. This might have been something that came up when we were, when, like, Rich was on the show with us. Okay, taking the studio time is expensive argument out of the picture, because I can't really speak to anyone's finances and I don't really know how much half this shit costs to do. I would prefer that bands would work on that type of rapid release schedule. And not that I'm expecting everyone to put out 2 albums a year, because I don't think that that's necessarily what I would want. Given that right now we're in this completely format agnostic digital music realm where, you know what, you could release like a good 3-song, you know, you could release a good 3-song EP every, you know, 4 months. And, well, I mean, digital music aside, yeah, and you could press 7 inches of those or whatever, right? But, like, you could put out, like, lots of rapid short form stuff as opposed to putting out, you know, an album every 4 years. And to me as a music fan, that is way more interesting. I mean, to me, thinking, like, putting on, like, a marketing hat on, that's more interesting, I think, especially in terms of, like, the way that, like, the online media works these days. You know, it gives you something to constantly have trickling out there onto, you know, onto your Facebook page, your Twitter account, or Tumblr, whatever else you use to promote your band, right? So I like it from that perspective, but just as a fan, I like consuming music that way, I think, more than waiting a long time for a record. This is why I like the Dirty Nil so much, is that, like, that band, you know, up until the recent 10-inch that they released, they had only ever done 7-inches. And I think, force them into that mode where, like, if you're going to put out a 7-inch, the song that's the lead one on there better be, like, a real corker of a song. Because, you know, it's not like you have an album in which you can, like, slot in a bunch of sleepers, because who cares? So, I don't know. I've always liked bands that operate in that mode. I wish more bands did, and some of my favorite bands do. But then you look at, like the Bouncing Souls, when they did that Ghosts on the Boardwalk experiment a few years ago, where they had basically a whole album worth of material. Instead of just going and recording an album, they put out a song a month. I thought that was really cool. I enjoyed it, but I kind of got the feeling it didn't go over well with people.
I think maybe because the material wasn't that great.
That might be it. It may have been that just the way that they went about it was a little bit too formulaic. It was like, oh, it's the first of the month, here's the new Bouncing Souls song. And, you know, they all kind of ran with, like, the same artwork and the same general style of announcement. To me, it's more interesting if, like, hey, there's a new EP by the Bouncing Souls out. It's really good. And then all of a sudden, 4 months later, hey, the Bouncing Souls released another new EP. Who knew? This one's really good, too. And it's different art and it's different, you know, different feel to it. And then, boom, here comes another one, right? I think that would be a little bit more interesting than, you know, first Monday of every month, we're going to release a song. Because I think that clearly came from a band that was used to doing things as albums. So even though they went with that release schedule, the music wasn't conceived to be in those short little bursts. I'm going to go with that. Yeah.
You know, for me, I don't, I mean, every, if I had, if, a ton, like a bunch of releases or like maybe like two albums like a year from an artist to me might be like overkill. I mean, I want to be able to kind of take in that album for like, you know, a long time and really kind of get to know that one. So I think a few, like one or two albums like a year or so or whatever it is, can be a bit overwhelming, and I don't have the time to appreciate it as much. But like, you know, one or two releases, one every, you know, 1 or 2 years, I think that's pretty good at least. And also, I don't feel, I'm not really much of a quantity person, I'm more of a quality. I like, you know, Against Me, they did one album this year and then one EP and then that's it. And we'll see what they do next year. Waiting, you know, 3 or 4 years for a new release. I honestly, when I heard that Against Me was putting out a new album and going into the studio, I think after the Russian Spies EP came out like in 2010 or 9, I was chomping at the bit to just hear the new songs. And I think they went to the studio like 2 or 3 times and it took about 2 years for it to be put out. And I was just dying. But at the same time, I mean, studio time matters. I mean, look how Off records their material. It's like done, the whole album's done in like a day.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't think more than one major release a year is really necessary, because I fear that material, unless they're really good, can get maybe, I don't want to say cheapened, but like, you know, like I don't feel like I'll be able to pay attention to, give as much attention to each release as much, and I'll feel a bit overwhelmed.
Yeah, I kind of agree with you. My favorite is basically when a band puts out one album a year, like, you know, that's perfect. But I would say that I think when bands rapidly record a lot of stuff, if they're able to get rid of the junk, I think rapid movement of creativity makes people the most creative, rather than sitting on things and thinking about things. I think when you just bang it out with a whole lot of, without much forethought, sometimes you get your most interesting, most wild, most, I guess, organic stuff. And I think it's the key with the Melvins. But Adam, why don't you play a track and then bring us back in, speaking of rapid organic stuff?
Oh, okay. You just want me just to come up with something off the top of my head. Yeah, okay, cool. So I was perusing my local show announcements tonight, and something caught my eye here that makes me excited, because I always like seeing these guys, and they've always been very good to Punk News. So there's a show coming up in November here in town, and the show will feature everyone's favorites, Pup. And Pup are playing with a couple bands that I really like. They're playing with a band called Pew 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 Gunshots. We've talked about them on the show before. We played some songs by them before. They're also playing with Wayfarer out of Kitchener, Ontario. And the Wayfarer guys they've been keeping in touch with me for a few years now. They released a really cool split a few years ago with a band called The Decay from Guelph, Ontario, that everyone called the Decayfarer split. You can actually get that thing for free. It was released by Juicebox Recordings, which releases their stuff for free. Anyways, Wayfarer just had a record come out themselves. It's their second full length. I'm going to play a song from that. Let's see what I will play as I type during the show and slow down typing, therefore losing my momentum. Anyways, yeah, so the new LP that came out, it's called Sleep Through the Light. It's being released on Kitchener's Sorrow Carrier Records and Montreal's Housebreaker Records. We're going to play the title track, I think, from that, because I have a copy of it sitting around somewhere. Are we going to do that? No, you know what? Let's do this. Let's play the song Worn Out. So this is Worn Out. It is off the new LP from Wayfarer called Sleep Through the Light, and you can find more info for it at, what is this band's website? I don't know. Go to Punk News, search for Wayfarer. We have lots of stuff on them there. Do that.
Stood in that stupid baseball uniform, convincing myself barely smoked these anymore. The shitty glove was so worn out, like the way that I feel as you taunt and yell. Don't get all sore now. Just stop and finally see.
right, we are back on the Punk News Podcast. Everyone still here? Everyone good?
Yep. Yep.
I think we may have lost John.
I'm rocking, baby. I'm playing it cool.
Whoa, whoa. Okay. Good. All right. What are we moving on to, John? What's our next story?
Fire us up with some Rancid, Alan. Fire us up with some Rancid.
Ah, Rancid. Okay, so we are clearly in pre-album release hype mode for the new Rancid record. We had three songs come out from them last week from their new LP called Honor Is All We Know. We had two songs plus the title track. This week we got another one. This song is called Face Up. You can check it out. It's over on YouTube right now. We've got it streaming on Punk News. We've got the YouTube thing embedded on Punk News, so you can find it there. So let's talk a little bit about Face Up. Did you guys check this out? I got some thoughts. I'll let you go first here.
I did check it out. I really liked the first three tracks they released. I didn't love this. I thought the first three tracks they released were, like I said last week, at this point, you can't really expect Rancid to reinvent themselves. They've already reinvented themselves like three times, and that's pretty good for any band. Reinventing yourself once is tough to do. Rancid, you know, Rancid was like a street punk band. Then they went to, like, I guess, ska punk, then hardcore, then back to, to Rancid again. The first three tracks are great. This one I kind of thought was just Rancid on autopilot. Like, the title's not that great. The lyrics aren't that great. It's acceptable, but this is really more like a track number 7, 8, or 9 as opposed to a track, you know, 1, 2, 3, or 12.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead, Greg.
Okay. I was okay with the first three tracks, but this one, there's like that one of the first lines that says, like, I'm looking for some trouble or something like that. I'm like, oh God, Tim, what are you doing? But I'm being kind of cautious with this album, especially after Domino's. I want to hear the whole thing. I'm not thrilled with Face Up though.
Huh. All right, I'm gonna go counter to this one. I liked this a lot better than the title track of the thing. Like, to me, Honor Is All We Know is just is a super uninspired song. I was a little bit curious why. I mean, one of our commenters said this, and this kind of echoes what I thought was like that. I'm A, surprised that that is the title track to the record, and B, sort of surprised that that song actually made it on the record in the first place. Because I think that the other material they released last week was much stronger. There was the ska song and then the non-ska song that kind of sounds like it could have been off Outcome of the Wolves. I like the way that this sounds. I mean, lyrically, it's the same sort of level of dumb that you get out of Rancid these days. But I think that this sounds really good. This sounds like it could have been off, you know, it's got that guitar tone that I really like out of Rancid's, you know, material from, like, say, Outcome the Wolves to Life Won't Wait. You know, this sounds like it could have been one of the more rocky songs off of Life Won't Wait. So I'm cool with it. It's not gonna win it's not gonna win any medals for the artistic quality of lyricism or anything like that. But I'm cool with it. I don't know. I keep wavering on this. I keep wavering whether I'm looking forward to this record or whether I'm dreading it.
Were you hurt once before and you don't want to allow yourself to get hurt again? Is that
I was hurt twice before. how many records have come out since 2000? Two?
Two plus the B-sides collection.
Then I've been hurt three times before. I don't know. This band's material since that 2000 record, which I really love, has just been not really shooting for the fences in my mind. So there's a lot of goodwill that's going towards this one. There was an article that ran on what's Brian's music blog? The Runout.
The Runout.
Right? Yeah, where Brian Yancey, ex Punk News, ex this podcast, was saying that like the world feels, you know, it feels primed for a Rancid revival right now, and I get that, I do, and hell, I'm primed for a Rancid revival. I'd really like to see them have a record that I love, and there's a part of me that is, I think, trying to gloss over maybe some of the dumb stuff that's on this one, because I really want to enjoy it. So I don't know. I'm trying to be very cautious with this to see how it works. I gotta say though, Rancid is a fucking merchandising machine.
Yes, they are.
Have
yes,
you taken you... a look at the like take a look at their website and pull up the pre-order from like the North American store, for example, for Rancid. It's like there are like you can buy this record in like any of like 12 different packages with different levels of crap that comes with the package, and then they're marking them as sold out as they go. So like if you didn't get Honor Is All We Know bundle number 3, well, you have lost. So if you want in on this, you better go down and order bundle number 5 or whatever we're up to now. That it's super interesting just to look at it from that side and go like, yeah, Rancid is a punk band. They're all for the streets and everything like that. But man, do they have their merchandising on track. Like this band knows how to make money off this stuff.
So Honor and merchandising are merchandising the two things that they know.
Yeah, seriously. I had two more things to say. First of all, I was looking at those bundles. I was surprised, you know, you talk about them merchandising themselves. Surprised they didn't go with like this is just the vinyl nerd in me just saying I'm surprised they didn't go for like a limited color run of the vinyl. They just went straight black. And then how is this, Adam, how is this song to you not one of the dumb stuff that's going to be on the album?
No, I mean like lyrically it's one of the dumb stuff, but it's propulsive and it made me happy. So it was one of those things where I'm listening to it and I'm like, yay, fun, Rancid. The thing about like Honor Is All We Know is that like it might like the song, not the record. It may have some of those qualities, but I could not turn off the dumb just outshone it. There was not as much of like propulsive guitar work in the title track that I was brought along by that and had a lot of fun with that, so that I would kind of forgive some lyrics that are dumb. Honor Is All We Know just feels so cliched to me. It's, you know, it's the same sort of thing that we joke about a little bit when we were talking about Sick of It All in weeks past. We're like, remember that DNC song that they had come out? We're just like, oh God, like this is like the most obvious thing that the band could write. That's what Honor Is All We Know feels like to me. It's just, I can't turn off the part of me that's just like, ugh, this is obvious.
It's very Rancid-esque.
I thought the lyrics for Face Up, that's what threw me off. And I only listened to it once and I don't really want to listen to it again just because, you know, these punk rock starter kit lyrics that showed up from a band that's over 25 years old now, 20 years old. I was expecting better from lyrically, but guitar work, it's pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, like I can forgive a lot of dumb if I'm having fun, and I have fun with this song. I didn't have so much fun with the title track. But if you tally them all up right now, I think we've got the same score for this. So we just need to see what happens when we get the rest of it. I think the one thing actually that I thought was kind of interesting about this, and it gives me some hope for this record, is that this song is like a minute and 30 seconds long or something like that. That's a good sign.
Yeah.
That's what I want from this band, I think, at this point. I really hope that this record moves at a clip, that it just jumps from song to song to song to song to song, and it does not spend too much time with any of these, because I think if you spend too much time with sort of punk by the numbers, you know, cliche-y street punk kind of stuff, unless you're doing something really artistically interesting like they were doing, say, on Life Won't Wait, I think you got to move or else the dumbness kind of becomes apparent. So if this record is sequenced in the right way, where it just kind of like hops along and just is fun, and then hey, it's a fun ska song, and boom, hey, it's a fun angry punk song, and boom, hey, it's another fun ska song, and they manage to do that, I think we'll be able to forgive a lot of the cliched stuff that comes out of it. So the fact that this song is like, this is like a midway song through the record. This is like track number 7 or something like that. And it's a minute 30. That's good. I hope most of the songs are that short.
Does the punk community want Rancid to win or Rancid to fail?
I think they want them to win at this point. I think we've seen them fail a few times, and it made us all feel sad.
Yeah, I think we're all pulling for Hanson.
This merchandising behemoth, we're all pulling for you guys. You can do it.
I don't know. Is it sad that we're trying to pull for them? I don't know anymore.
I mean, do we need to pull for Rancid? Meanwhile, like, some starving punk bands are, like, you know, not able to put gas in their van. we probably don't need to, like, you know, we don't need to start, like, a Kickstarter or anything to fund Rancid. I'm not saying that. But I think that a lot of, at least me, a lot of my youth is tied up identifying with Rancid. So there's a part that will validate the choices I made as a child that would really help if this was a good record.
Those bands just need to merchandise themselves better, obviously.
I don't want to drag out the Rancid discussion, but, you know, a lot of Rancid's t-shirts, like, aren't even that cool. It's like, here's a picture of a skull, Rancid. Here's a picture of a bottle on fire, Rancid, you know. Here's a picture of Margaret Thatcher, Rancid. But anyways.
I have one. It just says, it has the Rancid logo and then, like, the like Tim's guitar. I thought that was cool, but that's it.
Anyway, I hope Rancid wins. I think they're very talented musicians when they really try, and I'm looking forward to this. Speaking of another talented musician, this really surprised me. I really enjoyed this. Olivia Jean, who a lot of the Punk News listeners might not know, she was in a group, or still is in a group, called the Black Bells, and it's like goth garage rock. They're kind of cool. They did a single with Stephen Colbert. She's in the Jack White posse. She's putting out a solo album. The solo album is called Bathtub Killings. And at Punk News, we got to debut the first video from the new album. The video was for Reminisce, and the album's out October 14 on Jack White's label. I didn't really know a whole lot about Olivia Jean until I came across her. But, man, I mean, this track isn't super inventive, but I thought it was super good. It's kind of like sort of rockabilly, sort of new wave, sort of punk, sort of rock. And honestly, I really love the way she sang. I mean, she doesn't sound like Gwen Stefani, but I think she sort of had that same purposeful distance, but she still has humanity in the way she sings. I really, really enjoyed this track.
I did too. This is cool. This fits with a lot of the garagey stuff that I find that I'm drawn to these days. I don't know if the Punk News commenter crowd or anything like that is going to get behind something like this, but I enjoyed this. It was cool.
Yeah, I liked it too. I also knew I heard that band before, and it was from that hysterical Colbert Report sketch that they did at Third Man Records. I don't know did you guys watch that?
No, I did not.
Oh, it was really good. Jack White is actually a really funny guy.
So anyway, I recommend this. I'm going to keep following Olivia Jean and see what she comes out with next. And maybe I'll do a review if we can get a record. Anyway, I dig this. This is cool. I'd recommend checking it out. Let's keep trucking along with – this is interesting. And then James Williamson of the Stooges. He's putting out a new album called Relicked, which is basically him redoing a lot of late-era Stooges songs that never got a proper recording. Some of them were demos, some of them were only recorded live, some of them were never recorded. I think he kind of made an iffy choice of having a different singer on every track, mainly because I'm not into a lot of the singers on the album. But I'm really interested for the first track, which is going to have Jello on it. But James Williamson just debuted a new track called Cock in My Pocket, which is actually a pretty famous Stooges tune. And if you're, like, even a little bit into the Stooges, you know this track. This is probably their most famous later era songs, post Raw Power, with the exception of Maybe I Got It Right. But Cock in My Pocket, it's a pretty classic Stooges track. I thought it was that they had James Williamson had Gary Floyd of the Dicks do vocals. I gotta say, man, it's hard to follow Iggy, but Gary Floyd did a pretty admirable job on his version of this track.
This is really fun. It's nice to hear it kind of with the, I don't want to say like what would you call the piano in this? Like kind of like honky tonk piano?
But actually, in a way, I would even argue that the piano is a reference to John Cale, who produced the first Stooges album and who came up with that famous piano riff on I Want to Be Your Dog, where he just hits the same key over and over and over, and I Want to Be Your Dog. I think this is kind of the same thing.
Yeah, so it was very fun. I don't know. I don't know what to say for this. I think people should check this out. This is one of these stories that people are just going to ignore because there's an old person in it. And I feel that that's what happens a lot of the times.
It's the Stooges.
I know. But we never seem to get a lot of at least commenter response. You know, we'll post something about like, you know, something one of the Stooges is doing and, you know, we'll get nothing. And it bums me out. But this is fun. People should actually check this out.
Have young people forgotten about the significance of the Stooges? I mean, I wouldn't necessarily make this argument, but you could totally make the argument that the Stooges are the most important rock band or the most important punk rock band of all time.
I don't know. I feel that there's partly a generational thing where people just don't necessarily feel as comfortable engaging in the music that their peers are like, that people other than their peers are making. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And that I don't know that they, not that they have like reverence for these older bands, but they just don't feel, say, like equipped, and they don't want to walk in there and be like, even if they don't like it, say, they don't want to jump in and say that like, I hate this. And then it turns out like, oh no, you just said you hate this. And this was like one of the legends of the genre. Good job, idiot. Right? Maybe they're trying to avoid that kind of feedback. I don't know. It's always been like that. Whenever we've done these kind of things. I mean, I used to, like, for years, be the guy that was championing, like, us talking about, like, 77-era punk bands on the site. And it was always that kind of reaction when you'd post something like that. It would always, like, it would go by silently and no one would really say anything about it. But I have a feeling that it's one of those things that the kind of silent majority of the readership, the people that don't hang out and comment all day, they actually are into that stuff. That's my thought. I have no proof to back that up, but I think that's the case.
Facebook supports your hypothesis. Oh, this was fairly popular on Facebook, this article.
There you go. Cool.
I have a soft spot for rockabilly stuff. So rockabilly sounding stuff. So I like this. But being the most important rock or punk band, I think they were really, I mean, they're definitely the most important proto punk band for sure.
Yeah. Well,
you say all the front men that came after Iggy, like, always say how, like, you know, the Stooges and seeing Iggy live changed their life and stuff like that.
Very true. I would say the two most, well, I mean, people call the Stooges a punk band, but I don't think they're a punk band at all. I mean, the Stooges formed in 1966. That's when only rock and roll was only 10 years old. If you ask me, the Stooges are the last in line of the original rock and rollers. You know, in 1966, the Stones and the Beatles are just transitioning from R&B covers to, like, their own material, more or less. So I think if you call the Stooges punk rock, then that means the Stones and the Beatles are punk rock, which means Chuck Berry's punk rock, which doesn't make any sense. That really just means that those guys are all rock and roll. But, I mean, Stooges are very, very important. And actually, I sort of blame record store guys. Just, you know, I was in the record store last weekend, And I was talking to a guy about Ween, actually. I was like, oh, yeah, man, do you like Moist Boys? He's like, I don't like Moist Boys, you know. I'm like, damn, yo. And the point is, I think when a lot of people don't know about the older bands and stuff, I think record store guys and record store mentality, if somebody doesn't know about a certain type of music or genre, you shouldn't scorn them. You should invite them into that world for two reasons. A, to educate them and provide them the joy that the Stooges have provided me, but also, the more that we keep these old bands alive, the more those old guys get paid, but also the more the stuff that I'm into remains vibrant and accessible. So it's selfish and giving at the same time, if you ask me.
I can go with that. Yeah. Well, what else we got this week, John?
You want to wrap us up? You want me to wrap us up, Adam? Or you want us to wrap us up about Jeff Rosenstocko?
Oh, yes. Well, let's Jeff Rosenstock had a release that came out. Ricky, let's throw this right over to you, because you were the reviewer, right? You were into this. So we're talking about Hey Allison, the new 7-inch.
Yeah, he signed to Side One Dummy, which was I thought was interesting.
Shocking. Nobody saw that one coming in.
I'm admittedly behind. I'm very behind in on the whole Bond the music industry thing. So I'm slowly making my way up, catching up to that. So I thought this would be an interesting thing to review when it was made available. But I just want to say, Side One has put out a few really good releases out this year. This one is one of them. I thought this was kind of a cool, poppy, more harder, distorted kind of sound that he had in Arctica Vespucci, at least. It's not as poppy leaning as some of the Bomb the Music Industry stuff. But I thought the title track was really good. The B side, it's cool. But I thought that the Hey Allison track was a lot, definitely shined compared if you had to choose between one of them. Also, Side One is someone, I think someone asked in the comments of the review if they are pressing this into a 7-inch, and Side One is. They're doing like a whole Fest 13 celebration deluxe pack with this 7-inch being pressed in like silver and gold, I think, along with an Andrew Jackson Jihad 7-inch and a Smith Street Band 7-inch. So I guess you can check those out at their store. But yeah, it was cool. I think they said that he's doing a full length in 2015. So something to look out for sure.
Yeah, I think you can pick those seven inches up at Fest, but I think some of them you'll be able to get online later on, but no one's really clear. Yeah. I had something to say about, I guess we can wrap up this podcast. Adam, anything else you want to add to the podcast?
No, I think that just to come back to one of the things that Ricky was saying there about that you know, it's interesting that we're seeing all this kind of cool stuff come out on Side One. I think Side One has really started to show more personality in the past, say, 3 or 4 years than I think they ever have before. I mean, they were always a label that was they gave you the impression that kind of like they had the production down. They had the ability to get records like to, you know, pressed and out and into stores and everything like that. And like they were a dependable label, and they operated kind of at the, say, quality level of something like an Epiphat type thing. But they were never a label that really had all that much personality about them. And I think that's changing a lot. And I think the people that are running Side One are putting a lot more of, I think, their personal tastes kind of out there and doing less kind of dependable releases. Like we used to have certain stereotypes about Side One where, you know, if you were a band that was popular and got signed to a major and then are not on a major anymore, chances are you'll have a record coming out in Side One Dubby. And it felt like that for a while. But these days, you know, everything Side One seems to be putting out now is for the most part, you know, really interesting, really, you know, really well done stuff. So yeah, kudos to them. They're doing a lot better.
Actually, go ahead, Ricky.
I mean, just this year, this label has gotten some really good acts and put some of their some really good stuff out. Pup, Andrew Jackson Jihad. I think Chuck Reagan did one. I know the Pup. They're on their second or third pressing of the Pup album right now. So they're clearly doing this. Clearly has been a good year for them.
You know, whenever people talk about Side One Dummy now, they always say Gaslight Anthem. They were the band that went from small to big via Side One Dummy to huge, you know. Yeah. So right now, Jeff Rosenstock and Andrew Jackson Jihad are on a similar track, you know. They were on Asian Man, now they're up to Side One Dummy. Does Andrew Jackson Jihad, does Jeff Rosenstock have the ability, the skill, or the mass appeal, or could they develop that to become a huge band? Or are they too unique, too unusual to, you know, cross over like Gaslight Anthem did?
If they can, it's not a Side One, I think, that's making that happen.
Really?
I don't think Side One is making. I don't think Side One necessarily is taking bands that otherwise would not have that level of success and making that happen. I think that Side One knows how to pick good bands right now. And that's more of what's happening. Like, that Pup record was choice. Side One had nothing to do with it. Now, the fact that they were able to take it and realize that, like, hey, this record's really good, this band's really good and energetic, and they're going to tour their asses off behind it, that Side One can take that and then get that into the hands of everyone that needs to know about it and start to get that out there into stores and all that stuff, get that band on the tours. Like, that's their skill there, but they didn't – they didn't take like a mediocre product and then make it work. They went out and they found good product that already had, that was underrepresented, let's say, and then were able to kind of like throw their muscle behind it. So,
well, I'm saying, is that their skill though? Like, I mean, if you have a good product but you don't know who to sell it to, you might as well not have a good product.
Yeah, well, I think that speaks to what like side one skill is. So they, Gaslight would have got, I think, to where they were with or without side one. Mm-hmm. Only because they're a band that has that kind of appeal. Side One absolutely did great things for them. Now, the question is, like, could Epitaph have done that for them, too? I'd argue probably. I mean, the appeal of Gaslight isn't necessarily tied up with, like, with the label. You know, is Side One going to be able to take, you know, the Jeff Rosenstocks of the world or the Andrew Jackson Jihads of the world and make them that big? Well, probably not, but I think that Side One could give them as much of a push as they could, and then it's really up to the individual bands if they can make that connection or not.
I think you're seeing it already with Andrew Jackson Jihad.
You think they're going to become huge?
There's a possibility that they're on their way. I saw them, I think in late July or August, and it was a sold out show.
Wow!
It was a sold out show.
How many people? Like 400?
It's the Troubadour. So probably around there, but it was packed. And, if you look at, when they were on Asian Man, it was just the two of them.
400, now, Troubadour's 400. Wow.
Is it 400?
That's respectable, yeah.
Yeah, and that's a lot of really famous people have recorded there. John Lennon played there when he was still alive. But Andrew Jackson Jihad are, it seems to be, I was not thrilled with the show, not because of them, but because of their, of like these new fans that they have. And I don't want to, and I'm not like a dot, like a, I haven't been with them the whole, like the, since they started. But they have gotten, since the new album was released, they have, I have definitely grown a lot. And I think they're only growing now, especially even the band itself has grown. They have like three or four more people there on stage with them.
Is Andrew Jackson Jihad too weird to become massively popular though?
For mainstream success, I think so, probably. Unless a major label goes, you know what, you're just weird enough they're just weird enough for them to work out. But they're growing. They're definitely growing. I saw them as a two piece last year, and it was nowhere near a sold out show. Mm. And it was, I gotta tell you, I think that was actually a better show. It was a more intimate show. But I think because now they're on side one.
My name's Ricky Frankel. I saw Andrew Jackson Jihad in the basement in 2011. Now all these people that just got involved in 2014.
I don't mean to stop, but you know what? The maturity level at this podcast. I think you're seeing them take off a bit, especially, and also they're just they're really good. Knife Man, to me is one of my favorite albums.
Really, you like that more than the newest one? I like the newest one the best.
I like Knife Man. I like their more folk sound. This one I thought was a little more polished, but not too polished. They did it just right. I still like the album though.
Well, they have it. Ricky Frankel says Andrew Jackson Jihad is the next Bruce Springsteen in the E Street Band. You heard it here first. Let's wrap this podcast up. Ricky Frankel, thanks for being here and talking about how great Andrew Jackson Jihad is.
Anytime.
Adam White, thanks for being here and talking about how great taking a toddler to a water park is.
It's great.
And thanks again for listening. You can reach us at podcast@punknews.org, and we'll see you next week.